From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Do women coming of age today have different expectations about their power than their mothers did?
Later, a Bayview house undergoes a remarkable transformation.
Our sports contributor says the Bucks may be doing better than expected, but we should still keep our expectations modest for this season.
I think the Bucks certainly earned the position that they had achieved. What you have to keep in mind, though, is that achieving this year was never really the target.
And Peter Asher gets over his qualms about joining a British Invasion music tour.
When I thought about it, I was a little scornful, kind of going, well, really, you know, do old fat guys getting back together to sing songs from years ago, is that a bit pathetic? And actually it isn't, to my pleasant surprise. It's sort of exhilarating.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton yesterday asked the State Department to release all of the emails she sent or received using a private email server during her tenure there. The move comes amid an outcry about the practice, and her supporters hope it helps the storm blow over before Clinton announces her likely campaign for president.
The long-anticipated candidacy is, for some, more evidence of the rising stature of women in political life. But Dorothy Thomas would contend there's a lot more to the prominence of women in society than any one candidate or any potential candidate.
Thomas just finished a term as interim director of the Ms. Foundation for Women and is now working to chart the force of women in political, economic, and social terms. She'll talk about that work at an event sponsored by the League of Women Voters of Ozaukee County tomorrow. Ahead of that, she joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. I love the show.
So the work you're doing today, looking at the state of power for women economically, socially, politically, these are issues that people made a big deal about in the 1960s and 70s, especially during the battle over the Equal Rights Amendment. They don't get the same kind of headlines today. But what would you say has happened to that dynamic in the decades since?
I think when we started out in what's known as the second wave of feminism in the United States, we were really focused on the ways in which women continue to be disadvantaged, either by discrimination or violence in both private and public life. What's happened in the years since is that even though we still face very serious levels of violence and discrimination and tend to be preoccupied even with women's subordination, the fact of the matter is that women now play an increasing role in the success or failure of our economic life, our democracy, our culture, and our social institutions. And I think the newer generation of women's rights advocates is really looking at how that growing power of women can really have an affirmative or positive effect on economic and political life in states and in the country as a whole, not just for women, but really for everyone.
Well, and to that end, do you think to come of age as a woman today comes with a different set of assumptions about your own power, or one's own power economically or politically, than it did a generation ago or two generations ago?
I don't think there's really any doubt about that, actually. You can really see that although women still suffer from pay inequity, and we still find ourselves at the lower end of the economic ladder, and we are often sequestered into lower-paying minimum or less than minimum wage jobs. The fact of the matter is, at the same time, women constitute roughly half of the workforce in the United States as a whole. The state of Wisconsin sees 60-65% labor force participation by women. And some really good news you can see coming up in the lives of younger women, in that their levels of pay inequity tend to be smaller, and their ability to participate in the educational life of the country is better and better. So that now you see, particularly for white women, younger women, that they will outstrip their male counterparts in educational attainment.
Well, and you mentioned especially white women in this and younger women in this dynamic. I mean, it seems in a way risky to talk about women as though they are a monolithic group that is entirely ideologically or otherwise demographically aligned.
It is absolutely risky and in many ways not really borne out by the facts, in the sense that there is still a lot of differentiation, not only between women and men, but between differently situated women, so that women of color don't fare as well as white women in terms of pay equity measurements, in terms of access to basic educational attainments. You can definitely see that when race and gender discrimination interact in the American economy and even in our political life, women of color are likely to be on the receiving end of that discrimination more than white women. By the same token, however, an interesting other factor is beginning to develop where you see a commonality of interest between women across the board that relates to our growing role in the economic and political life of our country. So, for example, you'll really see that the interests of white women and women of color coincide around issues of raising the minimum wage. They also coincide around issues of access to health care, all available forms of health care for women and their families. They also coincide when you look at issues of democratic participation and reforms related to women's actual participation in voting and in political life, either as elected or appointed officials. In those places, even though white women and women of color may be somewhat differently situated and in some situations very differently situated, you still find that there's a commonality of interest that women are finding with one another, because increasingly the direction we go as women is really the direction that our economy goes and our politics go, and really our kind of social life goes. It's been demonstrated at a global level as well as at the level of the United States that when you increase women's participation, including women of color, you get better outcomes in the educational circumstance, better outcomes in the workplace, better outcomes in the country's political life, and actually better outcomes in terms of the functioning of civil society, issues like transparency and accountability. Those are places where women across the board are showing a common interest. And also, if you look at the electoral results as one measure, they're a place where women, including women in Wisconsin, are showing up to make the difference in terms of what the electoral outcomes are.
Well, so would you make the case that women simply have different priorities when it comes to decision-making in this regard than do men?
I think the evidence shows that in some cases that's true, that you'll find women will favor environment, health care, economic improvements, particularly in the areas of minimum wage, maybe slightly more than men, and men may be focused more on foreign policy issues or on issues of immigration or of national security than women. So you could, I think, begin to differentiate, or you could accurately differentiate between issues that women care about as a voting public and what men care about as a voting public. But that's sort of speaking very generally, because what's even more interesting to me is that increasingly the issues that women are of primary concern to women and that women are primarily or significantly affected by are also issues of primary concern to men. So that there is a kind of commonality of interest that both men and women are experiencing in some very key areas. For example, in the area of wages, and particularly in the area of the increase of the minimum wage, of tipped wages, you have a coincidence of interest between men and women, because now more than ever, most households have both men and women working, and they need both salaries, and they need those salaries to produce a living wage. And so it doesn't make any sense for families that are now dependent on women's wages to not support equal pay for equal work, but more importantly, to come together to support a wage rise that benefits everyone across the board. So although we have tended to see these issues in very polarized ways, men versus women, and also white women versus other women, In fact, I think you're seeing more of a commonality of interest, both amongst women and between women and a good portion of men, around some basic issues that pertain to the direction of the country as a whole, whether that has to do with the quality of our economy and who benefits and who doesn't, or it has to do with the character of our democracy and who participates and who doesn't.
Obviously, when you're talking about women's political power, there's a lot of talk about Hillary Clinton's potential candidacy for the presidency. But let me ask you, is it important when you're talking about issues that affect a lot of women and the common good? Is it most important that these be candidates that speak to those issues or women candidates that speak to those issues?
I think women candidates have been shown more often than male ones to speak to these kinds of issues. But again, I think the tendency to divide us up in this way by gender underestimates the degree to which women's vote plays a role for both women and male candidates. Of course, it goes to the larger point that increasing women's participation in our political life is absolutely required in order for us to have the robust democracy that we represent to the world and that we want to retain at home. I don't think having women underrepresented in the Wisconsin state legislature, which they obviously are relative to their presence in the population, makes good political, economic, or social sense at any level. By the same token, I think both female candidates and male candidates stand to benefit from a fuller understanding of the role that women play in being concerned about and advancing a very wide array of issues that don't necessarily easily divide into these are ones that women care about and these are ones that men care about. I think the fact of the matter is there's a growing consensus, male and female alike, that we as a country need to live up to our ideals of equality and democracy, and that entails improvements in economic equality, political participation, and that both needs to see more women participating in every level, but it also needs us to understand that this is not exclusively by and for women, that it is an agenda that men are many very sympathetic to, and also that stands to advance our economies and our polity as a whole, not just group by group.
Well, they are thought-provoking issues. And Dorothy Thomas, thank you so much.
Oh, it's entirely my pleasure, and I'm looking forward to being in Wisconsin, chilly as it may be.
Dorothy Hugh Thomas is the former head of the Ms. Foundation for Women and a leader in the women's rights and global human rights movements. She'll talk tomorrow morning in Mequon at a women's history brunch organized by the League of Women Voters of Ozaukee County. There's a link to more information from WUWM.com.
A break now, and then we'll hear about the transformation of an old house in Bayview into an experiment in residential living. That story when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The 12th Annual Sustainability Summit and Exposition reaches its three-day climax today with a series of tours featuring destination workshops.
Some spots, such as the Urban Ecology Center and the School of Freshwater Sciences, are well known. One located on Euclid Avenue in Bayview is not.
A very old Victorian has recently been transformed to become Heart House, an experiment in residential living. Several of its founders gave WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz a tour and a glimpse of their passion and vision for what they believe Heart House can achieve.
Some might recognize Ben Kohler's name as the man who brought Milwaukee's iconic former basketball court back into the public eye. But since last spring, he has thrown himself into this project. That meant a lot of hauling out and cleaning up.
That's the greatest story. We came into this project, we started with a 30-yard dumpster out front, and him in Minnesota.
Him is James Godsell, owner of the house, and the inspiration for what it was to become.
When we first started hauling all this stuff out of this house, obviously our neighbors were like, what's going on? We made it an effort, hey, I'm Ben, I'm Miguel, we're going to be doing this urban farm. And they're like, okay, I've heard that before. They kind of just were cordial, but nothing beyond that.
To soften the uncertainty, Godsell told neighbors,
I let the people know that fine young Americans were going to be moving in, and the neighbors were welcome to use the dumpster while it was there for their own stuff. I also told them that we were going to be organizing a block party once Ben and his team had gotten things to the point where they could rest and celebrate.
The celebration was a while in coming, as Ben Kohler and others tore out worn infrastructure and refinished floors. He says their only rule is don't start projects you can't finish. Kohler says the vision started with the original parlor, now Hart House's digital conferencing room.
And really why I say this room started it all is because Godsell's dream initially was we could have the technology to be able to connect partners all around the world and use the power of technology to communicate vision and connect vision. We have the latest technology to record music, edit video. We've Skyped with partners in Costa Rica, China.
The digital hardware looks impressive, but the rest of the house is sparsely furnished with lots of hand-me-down stuff. We move to what some might call a dining room.
This is what we call our bread-breaking brainstorm room. We believe in breaking bread with people. Like, there's some sort of sacred energy connection that happens when, like, you share food with someone, and also, like, to share food that you've grown. And just naturally, through conversation, comes ideas. And we wanted to be able to capture those ideas.
They are scribbled across whiteboards covering much of the room's walls.
So at any point, you know, you can get an idea, and as you can see, we've been working on many different things. And so the flow of this house, a lot of our ideas come from this room, and then they migrate into here.
To an adjacent room. It holds bunk beds and a small workstation.
The whole idea of this room is just to be able to have a space where you can crash out if you needed to take a nap. You could work, and you could also be able to do some R&D. So this is one of Jesse's Sweetwater Foundation systems, which was built by a student using all reclaimed materials.
He's pointing to a small demo aquaponic system. That's where Hart House collaborator Jesse Blom fits in.
The small aquaponic system uses a 20-gallon aquarium tank. We got 3 goldfish in there, and we've got just a little plastic box that sits up above the goldfish tank. The water is pumped to the plastic box where the plants are living. This was the first thing that I put in here at the Hart House last spring when we started this whole project, just because it's a way to engage people.
Blom created a many times larger fish and plant system in the basement. Just off the kitchen, we pop into the green room. Worms in giant tubs are quietly breaking down vegetable scraps to create soil. Nearby, trays overflow with microgreens and wheatgrass. This is Miguel Castro's domain.
During the development of this Hart House here, really enabled me to talk with people, meet people in the urban agricultural industry here in Milwaukee, and get a lot of insights. Through that experience, developing this concept for the green room here, which is beginning to come to fruition, it enabled me to kind of synthesize some of these ideas. So our goal now is to be able to transform this room into producing 4 salads a day, a salad a day.
So the next thing we'll do is we'll grab these wheatgrass trays, and we're going to juice some wheatgrass while I show you the kitchen. Miguel's going to make our salad, and then we'll get to show you Jesse Blom.
Can you sense there aren't enough hours in the day to tell the story? There's juice to be drunk and salad to be shared. The supersized aquaponic system Jesse Blom built in the basement will provide a harvestable salad or vegetable a day, which the team will serve to Hart House visitors who can also take classes taught in adjacent rooms. In the short time since its inception, more than 1,200 people have visited, from across town to faraway places like Costa Rica and Australia. Some spent a night or two. The brainchild of a guest from Central America stands in the backyard. Kohler describes the once highly functional hoop house as Hart House's most glorified failure to date.
Alex Pacheco of Earth University was on sabbatical. Part of his sabbatical program was to do a practical. So over a couple beers at the local beer garden, we decided to make a hoop house for sprouting and different things in the summer and spring. And Alex is from Costa Rica, and he had a way of making them in Costa Rica that at times I said, you know, Alex, I don't think this thing is going to stay, but he was a professor and a PhD, so who was I to say that it wasn't? So we built this with local materials from our local Home Depot for $157. It's our glorified failure because we didn't spend a lot of money. We were able to integrate with an incredible human being, with Alex Pacheco. But also, like, We can just unscrew this, take it apart, reuse the materials, and realize that in Wisconsin, you better have a pretty strong structure given all the snow that's dropping. So we are proud of it in the fact that, you know, we did it and it failed and we know what doesn't work and now we can go and do what does.
Hard House is about experimentation, and James Godsell inspired it. He contributed the building in which it stands. In 1966, in his native St. Louis, he took on a community organizer mantle, which he continued to wear while raising three children on his own and running a roofing company. Godsell is known for his poetic ramblings about restoring local economy and community through urban ag and aquaponics. Boomers sharing wisdom with and learning from millennials is central to his creed. Seldom at a loss for words, Godsell is rendered nearly speechless by the energy around him. He says retracing what led to Hard House would take hours to convey.
But I'll just say that I was faced with the prospect of selling the house in a deferred maintenance state, or taking a gamble that collaborations of what I call Earth Nation Americans and resourced boomers who are ready to give back and aspire to as much meaning and contribution in their final life's chapters as is possible, chip in. And it's been happening, as you've discovered with your conversations with Ben and Jesse and Miguel. It's a great story, and I look forward to sharing it over time when I have that 5 hours.
That brings us full circle to their neighbors on Euclid Avenue. Take the guy who lives next door.
He had these huge bamboo tree shrub things that, like, you literally couldn't look from our backyard into his yard. And according to him, he got the bamboo trees so he didn't have to look at our house and our backyard because it was a little disarrayed at the time.
Ben Kohler says after it became clear the Hard House crew was creating something special, they heard a knock at the door.
He shows up and he goes, "Hey, Ben, do you have a hedge trimmer?" And I was like, "Yeah, why?" And he was like, "'Cause I want to cut the bamboo down." He's like, "I want to see you. You're like my neighbor now. Like, well, let's be neighbors." And so we cut his hedges down.
A few months later, he returned.
After we had planted the garden and started harvesting, and he goes to me, "Hey, next summer, will you help me pull out the bamboo?" And I was like, "Yeah, why?" And he was like, "Because you inspired us. We want to do a vegetable garden next year." And it's like,
the team hopes Hard House serves as glue to pull community together.
Remembering humanity by reconnecting community.
For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
We heard from Ben Kohler, Miguel Garcia, Jesse Blom, and James Godsell. They're leading the experiment called Hard House in Bayview, and they spoke with Susan Bentz.
We'll take another break and then talk sports with contributor Howie Magner when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The Milwaukee Bucks will return to the BMO Harris-Bradley Center tomorrow evening for a game against the Washington Wizards.
They'll try to return to the win column after a rough road trip. It's actually been a while since basketball fans here have seen a rough patch like the one that's just occurred.
The Bucks sit at 32-29, around two-thirds of the way into the season. Howie Magner is our sports contributor, and he's here to help us take stock of the pro basketball world, at least as it's represented here. Nice to see you.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Mitch.
Let me start this question with a potential parallel here. The Milwaukee Brewers last season led the National League Central for about the first three quarters of the season. And when they were finally caught, we asked ourselves, were they really that good, or did our expectations for them just get too high? The Milwaukee Bucks have had a pretty darn good season so far. They ran into a real rough patch on a recent road trip, and now we're asking ourselves, well, what about our expectations of this season of the Milwaukee Bucks?
I don't know if they were too high, especially in light of the deadline trade that sent Brandon Knight off to Phoenix. And we can get into that in a little bit because
sure,
there were, you know, some reasons why they traded away basically the guy who'd been their best player for the season. But I think it was right to not expect much from this team other than improvement before the season. I think while they may not have overachieved, they certainly beat those expectations. And it's easy to understand why in hindsight. They had a very new-look team. I mean, they had a new coach who turned out really connected with his players. And I think one of the big question marks going into the season was how would Jason Kidd, who only had 1 year of head coaching experience and that year was with a veteran-laden team, how would he adapt to a team basically of youngsters that's rebuilding?
And that was certainly an issue with his predecessor.
Absolutely. And it turns out that he adapted pretty darn well. So I think you can say that perhaps from an outside perspective, Jason Kidd's coaching exceeded expectations. And then I think it filters down from that. The players bought into his system. They started performing really well. They didn't really have a, quote, star-level performer. Brandon Knight certainly played to the brink of an all-star level. Jabari Parker has a big name, a lot of hype coming in as the, number two overall draft pick. Giannis Antetokounmpo is a budding star. But there was nobody that you would point to and say, yeah, there's an all-star, there's a guy that is one of the best players in the league. It was more the collection performing better than the sum of its parts. I think the Bucks certainly earned the position that they had achieved. What you have to keep in mind, though, is that achieving this year was never really the target. The whole goal with the Bucks this year was to develop, to improve, to build a foundation that 2 or 3 or 4 years down the road will pay dividends. That's why they weren't afraid to trade away Brandon Knight at the deadline, because Brandon Knight was a player who was going to command a fairly big chunk of change in the offseason due to his status as a free agent or a restricted free agent. The Bucks had a decision to make. Were they going to want to commit a whole lot of money to Brandon Knight, or were they going to continue the slow build up and keep everybody together as a group and come together? They chose the latter. And now they've got a whole lot of salary cap room going forward. They've got a nice potential point guard piece coming in Michael Carter Williams. And the problem is that with that eye to the future being so important, it has certainly taken a toll on the success in the present. They just lost all four games on a West Coast road trip. I think they're sliding down toward the 500 mark. They will still make the playoffs.
Thankfully, they are in the Eastern Conference.
Exactly. They'll still make the playoffs. A lot of that will have to do with the fact that there won't be much competition from the teams below them. They may slip a seed line or two. They were pretty comfortably in the six seed spot, and they were actually challenging for the five seed spot. But now it looks like they're going to be pretty solid 6, 7, possibly 8, depending on how bad things get. But the thing to remember is, as exciting as it was and as good as it was to see them succeeding at this point, this isn't the goal. They have said from the start that they want to be a championship caliber team. To get there, you've got to make some short-term sacrifices. And I think the trade was a short-term sacrifice.
All right. So with that in mind, you talk salary cap. You talk looking to the future. Let's shift to football for a minute. And the Green Bay Packers declined to put the franchise tag on a big name in their offense. So what do you make of their offseason decision making at this point?
Well, the player you're referring to is Randall Cobb. Clearly, one of the main reasons the Packers were so successful last year, made a great receiving core tandem with Jordy Nelson, clearly a favorite target of Aaron Rodgers, does things on the football field that make defenses adjust what they do, really a guy that can hurt you. What are the Packers going to do with him now? The reports out there are saying that there are teams, and I think it was the Oakland Raiders specifically, who are willing to give Randall Cobb a deal that pays $11 million a year. It's more than what Jordy Nelson is making, and a lot of people are looking at Randall Cobb's situation in light of Jordy Nelson's contract situation. I don't know that that's a fair comparison. Look, they're two different types of receivers, but more to the point, it's not whether or not Randall Cobb is worth more or less than Jordy Nelson. That's an irrelevant point. It's Randall Cobb's worth is determined by what a team will be willing to pay him. And if a team is willing to pay him more than Jordy Nelson, be it the Packers or somebody else, then that's what his worth is. What the Packers have to decide is how much is he worth to them and in their grand scheme going forward. Ted Thompson has in the past shown that he's not afraid to let talented receivers walk. Now, I don't know that we've seen him in recent years let a player in the prime of Randall Cobb's career. You know, Randall Cobb is basically in his prime right now. This is going to be his first big contract that he signs. He let Greg Jennings go when Jennings was kind of starting to tail off. He let James Jones go. James was a bit of a late bloomer. So it's a bit of a different decision here, but the point remains that Ted Thompson is always building with an eye to the future. If it were me, I'd probably be willing to overpay a little bit for Randall Cobb. You had such a good thing going last year, and Cobb has been so productive that I think you're looking at a pretty big hole in the offense should you let him walk. The Packers drafted a lot of wide receivers last year. Jeff Janis, Devontae Adams really kind of showed something, but a different type of receiver from Randall Cobb. And there is a pretty stacked draft class of wide receiver candidates coming in this year. But I think the Green Bay Packers are built to win now, and I think you want to hit the ground running. I think if the Packers have their druthers, they would prefer to have Randall Cobb back. The question is, what is the market going to bear? In the end, I think Randall Cobb realizes that for him to be his best, the Packers are the best situation for him. Is that
so? You'd expect Randall Cobb back in a Packers uniform?
I would think so. Is it worth an extra million or two a year to stay with a successful situation? I think in the end, he will decide that is the case.
Well, and he has to wonder whether right, so much of his success was because Aaron Rodgers was throwing the ball
sure.
to him, and how much success would he get in Oakland?
Yep, Greg Jennings chased money in Minnesota. His quarterback situation was horrible, and you haven't heard from him since. James Jones chased money in Oakland. His quarterback situation was horrible. You haven't really heard from him since. I think Cobb is more talented in his stage of his career than those two guys are. But still, unless you're going to go to the New England Patriots or the Denver Broncos or the New Orleans Saints, you are going to see a significant drop-off in quarterback play than what you will see in Green Bay. And if you're a receiver, somebody's got to be there to get you the ball.
Okay, so let's switch briefly to baseball because it's pretty early in spring training right now. The Brewers opened their spring training schedule against the UWM Panthers, and it took them a little while to get going. Should we be worried?
No. No. Of course. Batten down the hatches. A long road. But good for UWM for showing well early on, right?
Exactly. But let's talk about one area that's gotten some attention in recent days. The Brewers re-signed K-Rod.
Yeah.
Again.
I want to nickname him Francisco Rodriguez Capistrano because he always returns, just like the Swallows.
That is excellent.
Thank you. It hasn't caught on yet. So
from Capuano to Capistrano.
Nicely done. Look, what it comes down to is he's very comfortable here. The Brewers are comfortable having him in their bullpen. They always seem to find some type of middle ground where they can meet. And I believe his current deal is in the end going to be like 2 years worth $13 million, but some of the salary is going to be deferred. So I think he's going to get $3 million this year or $6 million next year, and the rest is deferred with like a club option or
something.
And
this is a guy who's been accused of being washed up several times in his career and has always bounced back.
That's the reason he ended up with the Brewers, right? I mean, the Mets wanted to get rid of him. Now, some of that was due to clubhouse issues and his temper, and they didn't want him around. But a lot of it was they didn't think his talent was worth that trouble. He's come to Milwaukee, and he's really kind of rekindled his career. When you consider Francisco Rodriguez, a lot of people are always going to talk about the off-field issues, the domestic violence, and that's certainly important from a baseball-only standpoint. Can he help the Brewers? He has shown to do so in the past. His addition there makes the bullpen better. Leaving the morality aside, and I get that, and I respect the people who have those concerns. They are real concerns. From a baseball-only standpoint, signing him makes the bullpen better and does so at a fairly comfortable price point.
The one person that we haven't heard a lot about but who might have a lot riding on this season, and maybe we have heard a lot about him in other circles, but Ryan Braun had had quite the down year last year. What should we be looking for him to accomplish this year?
Well, if the Brewers are going to make the playoffs, if the Brewers are going to contend for the playoffs, Ryan Braun has to be much closer to the Ryan Braun of old than the Ryan Braun you saw last season. Basically, my theory has been no matter what offseason moves the Brewers made, no matter who left or who came back, their success comes down to one thing, the offseason move to correct Ryan Braun's thumb with this cryotherapy procedure that he underwent. And don't ask me to tell you what it is. I don't know, but something about freezing some nerves in his thumb to remove the pain. All the reports from the offseason are, hey, I'm feeling great. I think the surgery was a success. I can't wait to get back. That's great. What else are you going to say? My thumb feels horrible. The season's lost. The true test will come not really even in April or spring training. It will come in the middle of the season when you see whether or not the thumb is holding up. I wonder if the Brewers will maybe manage his time a little bit more to help avoid the injury bug. But I think as Braun goes, so will the Brewers go. And Brewers fans, however much anger they have remaining from the PED scandal that Braun took them through, the bottom line is if this team is going to succeed, Ryan Braun has to be a star performer in the middle of that lineup. And in order for him to be a star performer, that thumb has to be healthy.
And if it's not, maybe we'll all need cryotherapy.
That could be correct.
Howie, thanks.
Thanks, Mitch.
Howie Magner writes the Sports Nut column for Milwaukee Magazine's website, and he is senior editor at the magazine. He's also our regular sports contributor.
We'll take one last break, and then we'll have a conversation with Peter Asher, who hit it big in the pop music world of the early 1960s, but went on to hit it bigger as a record producer. He returns to the stage this evening in Milwaukee. We'll be back in just a moment on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
And don't allow the day here inside where I hide with my loneliness. I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love.
A World Without Love was by far the biggest international hit for the duo of Peter and Gordon. It reached number one in the U.S. in June of 1964, right around the height of Beatlemania, which makes sense since Paul McCartney wrote that song.
McCartney passed the song along to Peter Asher and also dated Asher's sister, actress Jane Asher. Peter and Gordon, meanwhile, went on to record a few more hits, including I Go to Pieces. But Asher eventually went on to work for the Beatles label Apple Records and then became an award-winning producer for musicians such as James Taylor and Linda Ronstadt.
More recently, though, he's gone back on stage to play his music and to narrate a tour with some of his fellow British Invasion acts. That's what brings him to Milwaukee's Pabst Theater this evening. Peter Asher joined us by phone from New York. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So you have had a distinguished, a Grammy Award-winning career as a producer in the many years since you were on the charts. So I would think that you don't necessarily need to be playing live music, but what do you still get from doing it?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I wasn't sure about it myself. For all those years when I wasn't doing it, you know, there was 38 years after Gordon and I stopped singing before I did any, I mean, I always sang on records I was making and stuff and things, but before I set foot on the stage. And it was actually Paul Schaefer who was putting together a benefit for Mike Smith from the Dave Clark Five and persuaded me that now was the time to get hold of Gordon and get back together and sing. So we did, initially just that one charity event, but it turned out to be fun. And I confess I had reservations about whether singing the old songs, you know, so many years later made any sense. But actually, I realized how much they mean to people, you know, when we did that show, and then we did a number more because we had fun doing it. And that's how it began. And then, you know, I'm glad it did, of course, because then Gordon sadly died a few years later. And then again, I had to decide, well, does that mean I'm never going to sing them again or what? And so I decided to work out versions of them, you know, without him, or in some case, wherever I can, I use a video of Gordon. And I put together a sort of memoir show of my own. And then they asked me if I wanted to be part of this sort of 60s anniversary package thing and host it. And you know, tell some stories and add some background and some details to try and give the whole event some cohesion. And I said yes to all of the above. I think generally most of my career has been down to kind of saying, oh, yes, okay, that sounds cool, I'll do that, you know, to various things. Yes, I'll be a producer. Yes, I'll be a manager. Yes, I'll be vice president of Sony, you know, all the things that somebody said, why don't you do this? And I went, that'd be cool. I've never done that before. So it's kind of like that. And it's turning out, hosting this little tour is turning out to be amazing fun, and the music is great.
Well, and as you say, the songs really do still mean things to people. These are not museum pieces.
No, they do. That's what's interesting. I was, admittedly, when I thought about it, I was a little scornful, kind of going, well, really, you know, do old fat guys getting back together to sing songs from years ago? Is that a bit pathetic? And actually, it isn't. To my pleasant surprise, it's sort of exhilarating. And, you know, we still sound pretty good. And, you know, we are the real people doing the songs, and people appreciate that. And very much join in the, and you know, the advantage of playing small places like the Birchmere or where we're playing there is, you know, very far from being arenas. We can actually meet all the audience afterwards and sign stuff. You'd be amazed how many people bring ancient vinyl and, you know, album sleeves and stuff for us to sign. And they tell stories about what the songs meant for them, what they were doing at the time, and or what their parents told them about it, or whatever it is. It's fascinating.
I would imagine the Peter Asher of, say, 1964 would have found it a bit surreal to think that he would still be people would still be paying to hear him play 50 years later.
I think nobody believed it at the time. I mean, going back then, the first question people would ask in an interview, even an interview like this, used to be, well, "What are you going to do when all this is over?" You know, because it was accepted wisdom that a career in popular music would last a couple of years, and then you'd go back to being a milkman or whatever you did, you know, like Freddie and the Dreamers. And the idea of it actually having longevity or being celebrated 50 years later, or the very best of it, which is, of course, the Beatles, being musically celebrated and recognized globally as among the most important musicians of this century, was unthinkable, you know, and all that has happened and is happening.
Now, the song, you mentioned the Beatles, the song that most people, especially in this country, would know you for is a song that Paul McCartney wrote, and he was your house guest for quite a while, right?
He was, for a couple of years, but very much off and on when they weren't on the road. They were on the road a lot. So, but yes, he was going out with my sister Jane, and eventually our parents, that meant he was hanging around the house a lot. Eventually, our parents took pity on him and offered him the guest room at the top of the house, which was next door to my bedroom. So we shared that floor of the house for a while.
Well, and that would be a remarkable time to be sharing a floor of a house with Paul McCartney.
It was. I mean, the whole thing was kind of bizarre because this was our family home in Wimpole Street, you know, which is, as you may know, Wimpole Street and Harley Street are the medical district. So that was my father's consulting room as well. So that's where he saw patients. So it must have been rather puzzling for patients coming to see the eminent physician, Dr. Asher, to find, you know, a bunch of teenage girls on the doorstep night and day. And they would have no idea why. But of course, people would find out where Paul was staying. So the whole thing was pretty surreal.
Thank goodness the internet was not around in those days.
That is true. That's a good point.
Well, you mentioned your father. Do I also understand, even before there were Beatles or even the Quarrymen, George Martin was an oboe student of your mother's?
I know. Isn't that weird? If you couldn't make that stuff up. It's extraordinary. But yes, George was an oboe student of my mother's.
Well, you went on to be head of A&R for Apple Records as the Beatles were finishing their remarkable run. Is it at all painful to think of those last couple of years of the Beatles when, you know, they were suing each other and there was so much basically, you know, public dirty laundry?
You know, I think it would have been nice if it all hadn't happened, but it's not really painful. I mean, it all got sorted out pretty much and everyone's friends now. You know, both the living Beatles and the widows are all friends and, you know, it's those things were always. It was probably quite crummy at the time to be involved with it, and certainly when you get into business fights with old friends, it can be horrible.
Well, and I imagine there was not at that point a lot of precedent for this stuff to happen, being that there had been no one quite as big as the Beatles in the way they were big up until that point.
That's true. I think that's true. Yeah, bands had broken up before, but no band with quite as much at stake. Undoubtedly true. And of course, the culminating fight was about Alan Klein, you know, coming in to run the whole of Apple, and I was very much on Paul's side because I knew Alan already from New York. That's why when Alan came in, by that time I was producing James Taylor, who I'd found and signed to Apple, and That's why we decided to leave Apple and that I would become James's manager and try and extricate him from the whole thing, which I did.
Well, and so you mentioned James Taylor. Linda Ronstadt was another person that you produced over the course of time.
Yep.
What have those two in particular meant to your career?
Oh, a huge amount. I mean, the easiest way to be a great producer is to be producing great artists. And James and Linda are the very best in their respective fields. You know, James is an extraordinary guitarist and songwriter and singer. And Linda is quite simply the best chick singer I've ever heard in my life, in my view. She's unbeatable. And I listen to those records today and still just I'm bowled over by the sheer excellence of her singing. So they mean a great deal to my career, obviously. They've won me Grammys. They have made me money. They've made some of the finest album-making experiences of my life. You know, I enjoyed working on the albums I did with them as much or more than anything I've ever done. I mean, of all the things I get to do, I still find producing records in the studio probably the most fun, the most rewarding, and the one I'll give up last, as long as people ask me to do it, which, thank goodness they do, I keep working. And I love doing that, and I'm very proud of some of the records I did with James and with Linda. And that pride must, of course, be shared with their own excellence.
Well, and so who are some of the other musicians that you have produced that you might think, all things being equal, maybe they should have gone on to the kind of international stardom that James Taylor and Linda Ronstadt did?
Oh, that's the hard one. You mean people I produced flops I have had?
Oh, yeah. Sure, they appreciate that.
there's a few of those. Now, I've made some records that people I thought would do better than they did. Yes, I can't think that I'd want to pick any out in particular, but it's always frustrating when you do something you think is good and, you know, the public doesn't necessarily agree, but equally it's incredibly rewarding when you think someone's good and, like James, you know, when I found him was entirely unknown and the public agree in spades to the point where gets bigger than either James or I ever expected.
Do you remember what you saw in James or know what he saw in you to make the two of you working together the right thing at the right time?
What I saw in him was just excellent. I mean, he played guitar with the skill of a classical guitarist. He'd been listening to, you know, Julian Bream and Segovia as well as to folkies. And yet he'd got the chord sense, the harmonic sense of a jazz musician. You know? And then this beautiful voice. It was like, what's not to like? I mean, everything about James, his songwriting, his singing, his playing, excellent. It's hard for me to say what he liked about me. I mean, I've read some interviews where he said, you know, that he thought I was the right producer because, I like to keep things generally quite organized and pick out good ideas and know when to abandon an idea and not get bogged down, which is something James is capable of, you know, in pursuing something that ultimately, the reason it's not working is it's just not quite right. And things like that, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. Making records is a tremendously collaborative effort. It's very hard to say afterwards who did what.
How much of producing can be taught and how much of it just really comes intuitively?
Good question. I'm not sure I know the answer. I think it is intuition, but there's things I could explain to people of how I try to do things and why I do them the way I do. But then probably some real genius producer might ignore everything I said and do brilliantly. So the interesting thing about producers is they usually don't get to watch each other work. So they don't necessarily know how everyone else is doing it, you know? You know, the person who can best judge a producer would be the musicians who work for several different ones and can tell you, actually, who does what and why and what works. It would be interesting to know.
Well, and who were the people that were maybe influential that you worked with that maybe even without your knowing it at the time were influenced the producer you became?
You mean producers or artists?
Well, I wonder, you know, when you first sat down to and became a producer and you went from being musician to A&R guy to producer, you know, were there lessons along the way that you gained that said this
I did get to watch George Martin in the studio a bit, but not that much. Beatles sessions were generally on their own, but I did get to watch George a bit and talk to George. I'm a great admirer of his, of course, and certainly one of the things he taught me is, you know, when you're dealing with brilliant artists, you certainly pay attention to their ideas very much, you know, and your job half the time is to help guide their ideas to fruition rather than impose your own. I don't know who else I learned from, and I think I've learned something from every musician and every artist I've worked with, but I'm not sure I could quantify what.
Sure. Well, and I always wonder, you know, whether there's a sports analogy to be made. I mean, as you know, someone who had a share of stardom. I mean, you co-headlined with the Rolling Stones, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
You know, when you go from that to being a producer, do you still have the itch? I mean, do you feel like the football player who becomes the manager or the baseball player who becomes the manager and at some level?
To an extent, I don't really know how they feel, though, but I don't miss being famous. I mean, I have a pleasant level of sort of ultra minor celebrity, and I'm entirely happy there. You know, it's a good place to be. You know, when you want, you can make sure people know who you are, and they go, oh, really? And, you know, when you don't want, you can walk down the street. So I certainly don't lust after any kind of global media fame, that's for sure.
And I hope that didn't come off as trying to sound like a pop psychologist here. I was just trying to...
No, it's an interesting question, but, I mean, I think everybody likes it. Sort of. I mean, no question. When I've done something that's on TV and someone goes, ooh, so you're on television last night, you do kind of go, cool. But enough is enough, you know?
Well, and I think one of those givens that people probably think of when they think of the era from which you emerged, the early 60s, is of that era as possessing a certain innocence that they might believe does not exist today. Do you think, is that a fair categorization of the way the music industry was circa 1964 versus circa 2015?
Yes, it was innocent, but not by wish, you know, it was in a muddle. You know, people didn't usually know what they were doing very much. It was all new, so maybe that makes it sort of innocent. But there were also just as many crooks and bad guys and ripoffs as there are now, if not more. You know, probably more actually. And now, of course, it's changed in a different way. It's become less crooked and more corporate. You know? There's less actual guys, you know, selling records out of the back of their car and pretending they're promotional or whatever the scams were back then. But there's more just general corporate flim-flam going on in every field, including the music business.
Certainly those of us in radio are no longer getting paid by the record companies.
You're not even getting any good bribes anymore, unfortunately. Those days are gone, too. So. I'm afraid it's all gone away.
Well, listen, it was a real a delight to chat with you, Peter Asher. I appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure. I enjoy talking to you very much. Thank you.
Peter Asher was half of the duo with the late Gordon Waller, Peter and Gordon. He'll play the Pabst Theater this evening along with fellow British Invasion artists such as Denny Lane of the Moody Blues, Terry Sylvester of the Hollies, and Chad and Jeremy. That is Friday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tite. Great to have you along today. And don't forget, you can listen to us over the weekend as well. Lake Effect Weekend is tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3.
It's all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned because Fresh Air is next.
Not a shirt on my back, not a penny to my name. Lord, I can't go home this alone.